Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Rob Bound.
On the show this week, a musical legend, and we don't say it lightly, Tony Allen, the man Brian Eno calls perhaps the greatest drummer ever and architect of the Afrobeat sound, will be joining us in the studio.
We'll also be looking at the effortless prose, and we do say that lightheartedly, of none other than Donald Trump. McSweeney's writer, Rob Sears, creator of new book The Beautiful Poetry of Donald Trump, which uses the US president's social media outburst as source copy, will be here later.
And we'll be welcoming back to the show musician Emmy the Great. The composer, also known as Emily Moss, will be explaining why she's now setting Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice to music.
All that, plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan will be providing the news look ahead, and we'll play a Tony Allen classic or two as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
That sounds like a fantastic lineup for the show, Tom. Do you think all our guests, if we had them all in a green room together, in a sort of like, you know, a kind of chat show kind of environment, do you think they'd all get on?
I was going to say, do you think they'd give a tune? I think they would.
Well, they're a musical. They're
it
a
would
musical
start,
bunch.
It would start with a tapping foot.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
It would be infectious.
I think it'd
not,
be pretty
not
good.
Not literally. And then it would build and build.
You'd have Emmy the Great singing the words of Donald Trump, backed up by Tony Allen on drums.
And then I could just come in, a haunting falsetto over it all.
Is that what you like?
Maybe.
Yeah? Do you have to arrange anything downstairs to achieve those notes, the castrati?
A vocal arrangement, as it were. Possibly, Rob.
And what songs do you favour then for the higher register on the karaoke nights?
I don't know, a bit of Barry Gibb.
Yeah, okay. All parts of Bohemian Rhapsody. All parts G.
Yeah.
Okay.
Including Kenny.
Well, we've got quite a... It sounds like we've got... What should we call it? A packed show?
Jam-packed.
Yeah? As if it was like letters at Christmas, we'd have a sort of a bulging sack. Should we say that?
Yeah.
Can we say that?
Another man whose sack is positively engorged with news from the week ahead.
I can see him peeping around the corner. It's Henry Rees-Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all right.
Hello, Henry. Welcome to The Weekly.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Henry.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, nice one. Yeah, good. Thank you.
We introduced you. I don't know whether you know, because you were probably opening the door to come into the studio at the time. Tom was talking about the size of the appendage with which you're carrying your news this week.
It has to be capacious, doesn't it, with the amount of news that I bring every week. I mean, it's litre. They measure space in sacks by litre,
don't they? Cubic litre.
I think so.
Cubic litres, yeah. When you're buying a rucksack, I've noticed that that's the main metric used.
So, look ahead-wise, just empty yourself over the table here in Studio One right now.
I will, thank you. On the 1st of October, the big day in Catalonia is at least scheduled. They're meant to have an independence referendum.
It's more of a sort of plebiscite or just chat, isn't it? In legal terms.
Well, in legal terms, yes. And obviously the run-up to this has been rancorous by any standards, including the sending of thousands of policemen, of Castilian policemen, to Catalonia in order to try to disrupt the vote. My favourite episode of the whole saga has been this.
What's going on there?
Do you know what's going on
here?
It's
a ferry in Barcelona Harbour, is it?
Yeah, it is. So basically, the Castilian police chartered three ferries, both to transport the police to Catalonia, but also to house them while they were there. And one of them, inexplicably, was adorned with some famous Warner Brothers characters.
Okay.
And maybe you can describe who they are, what you can see, Tom. You're holding the picture now.
Well, from left to right, the roll call reads Wile E. Coyote. It is Tweety Pie, isn't it? Is that...
Yeah, the little yellow bird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does it say Moby on it?
Now,
it
this is the
Moby.
Other aspect of the design of the boat.
Was he an old Warner Brothers character, Moby, before he was a singer?
Or are we talking Dick?
I won't want to hazard a guess,
sounds
frankly.
Like it.
But it's quite absurd, isn't it? And it's basically a decal which has been painted or somehow applied onto the entire...
They've done it very well. It goes all the way up to the chimney.
Very
right,
good.
Yeah, onto the entire
no expense
side
spared.
of the cruise ship that
that's
housing
Daffy
the Castilian
Duck, isn't it, the run on the right?
That's it, Daffy Duck, yeah. And then, of course, the boat is inexplicably called Moby. I don't know why.
Well, a nautical, there's obviously a nautical
connection. If you were
a
Castilian policeman, would you feel that you could go out and sort of roam the streets?
I would feel that my authority had been somewhat undermined by the fact that these were my temporary quarters, to be entirely honest with you.
It doesn't look like a load of barracks, does it, really?
No, it doesn't, no.
Oh, that's exactly what I thought it did look like.
So, obviously, the whole process has been quite fraught, and I hope that this would bring some levity
to it.
It
certainly has done that.
You've managed to drag it down. Into sordidity again.
We haven't. It's fine.
Okay, so...
What else is happening?
I want to address... I'm not sure if this is UK-specific or a global phenomenon, but basically, in October, lots of charities, particularly health-oriented charities, have adopted October as a month to start campaigns to get people to change bad habits. So Macmillan's, the cancer charity in Britain, has Go Sober for October.
Surely it should be called Oct-Sober.
Yeah.
Well, funny you should say that, because the Department of Health in Britain has made it Stop-tober to try to stop people from smoking.
That's less good than Oct-Sober.
Macmillan tick.
Yeah.
Young people cross.
Yeah, the government, no.
not again.
I'd be interested in getting your views Stop-tober. On this format of public health drive. Do you think that it's instructive?
Well, no, it does work. Yeah. Because people are sheep, aren't they? They're positively ovine in their behaviour, and they follow...
Yeah, I mean, things like in terms of punning campaign, I mean, Movember was quite a thing, wasn't it? When everyone shaved their beard off.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was one of the first in England, actually.
That's still around, I think.
And that was a testicular cancer thing, wasn't it?
But that was charity, wasn't it? That was raising money for charity rather than trying to actually change people's behaviour in a particular direction.
Okay. So I can stop, what's it? Go Sober for October. I've seen posters for that on the Tube and things like that.
And Stoptober.
I mean, posters for like that in my bathroom that my wife's put up.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with that.
Just goes over this Monday. Small manageable chunks. I think that's how that works.
But you're saying that they do work.
Well, I think people, if somebody joins in and gets a month of healthier living, does it matter what their motivation was, even if they've missed a better pun?
I suppose it's implicit, isn't it, in those campaigns that you can just go mental for the rest of the year.
Do you think it is? Well, maybe
I don't know. is there an implied logic there? Or
I don't know.
Is that specious?
And also... Is October the time? I mean, isn't October a bit depressing?
That's when you need it the most to get you through, isn't it?
I don't know. I think October's an all right one.
Really?
Yeah.
It's between summer revelry and the festivities of December.
Yeah, I think you need quite a sort of decent run up to take it to.
But the nights are drawing in. I feel like I need to just
Daddy's little helper.
Pop open a pick pool.
Hit flask.
Daddy's coping juice for the evening.
Yeah. Sure.
As I do genuinely call it, but what other ones are there?
You're going to get some special labels made to put over the bottle of Riesling
or whatever it might be. You could do.
Yeah.
I remember when Movember started.
DCJ engraved into your hip flask.
It's good. I wasn't on board with it because I don't know, I'm just dubious about just the moustache.
Mm.
And I tried to quickly rally people around Decemberd, but it got no traction.
Really?
Also, beards are too ubiquitous.
Well, they are now. This was years ago.
Hmm. And you were rocking one back then?
Well, I mean,
you were growing one for December.
Yeah, it's only been in my late 30s that I've needed to shave.
Got it. Also on the 1st of October, we're expecting the first same-sex couples to get married in Germany. Now, you might be thinking, hang about, wasn't this legislation passed months ago? It was. But basically, there was provision in the legislation that it wouldn't come into force until the first day of the third month following the declaration. And Zeit magazine also reported that that period was meant to also give registry offices time to adapt to the change. How much adaption is needed?
I was going to say, to sort of not be shocked by it.
Yeah, When
couples of the same sex walk into the room, try not to take a sharp intake of breath.
It conjures up the idea of a kind of very, very conservative regional registry offices that have to take some time to
I imagine, practice
smiling in the mirror.
Yeah.
If you can see it for the... Stoptober messages written all over it.
Yeah.
So, many happy returns. Is that what you say with weddings?
So when
you come?
No, I don't think so.
That's birthdays.
Oh, that's birthdays.
Do you just say
happy wedding? Happy marriage?
Congratulations.
Oh, just congrats.
Yeah.
Congratulations to any couple
with
who
a German
are
flavor,
in Germany.
I'm sure you could throw a Genau in there as well.
Genau. Yeah. Is this happening on the 1st of October?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So that'll be all our German press. There'll be a lot of, on the 2nd of October, a lot of...
We look forward to a lot of images of happy couples.
A lot of happy couples.
And maybe
a lot of disgruntled looking, what do you call them, celebrants.
Yeah, exactly. So we can look forward to that.
Good. Well, that's. I'm looking forward to. What is it? Next Thursday's papers. Okay. Good.
Thank you, Henry.
That was really good. That had all sorts of stuff in it.
Thanks very much. Yeah, because it's been a little bit. I don't know. Recently, I've got some feedback that it's been, you know, going too far in either direction. So I tried to kind of reach a middle ground.
Are we still talking about the Monocle Weekly News?
Tight fitting underpants is the answer.
We often hear of musicians who are supposedly genre-defining, but few can really say they had a hand in creating an entire genre from scratch.
Drummer Tony Allen can make that claim. As former rhythm man for pioneering Nigerian musician Fela Kuti in the 1970s, Tony was the beat that shaped the Afrobeat sound. He's gone on to appear on records by artists ranging from Damon Albarn to Charlotte Gainsbourg, and at 77 years old, he shows no sign of slowing down yet. He's just released his new album, The Source, and a little earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller sat down to hear more.
I wanted to start by asking about the new album, The Source, on Blue Note, great jazz label, and of course you prefaced it with a short tribute to Art Blakey. Does this feel for you like you going back to the music that first inspired you?
Well, in a way, yes, because when we're talking about jazz, you know, my inspiration first was coming from Art Blakey, you know, the Jazz Messengers. Well, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, nobody ever talk about doing jazz anymore. People would, apart from, okay, the normal American jazz music that's still on, apart from that, jazz is kind of disappearing, you know, like if we want to start playing the standard jazz is, you know, it's everybody playing it, and then you have to kind of be the top of what was there before, which is not kind of so easy to get at, you know. Personally, me, I just want to make people to understand that my way of drumming is coming from jazz, is fusion of jazz plus the jungle, whatever you could call it, you know. It's a fusion I'm doing, and then I didn't want to introduce that, my way of drumming, to this so-called jazz, not maintaining the same movement.
So when you've been making these recent records, was it for you a matter of reconnecting with what you felt the first time you heard Art Blakey?
Well, you see, yes, I heard Art Blakey in a different, you know, way compared to the others because of his influence that he got from Africa and that the way he used it, the way he had used it in his works, not like it's American, you know, but it's kind of like his drums were like speaking a language that wasn't his own language there, you know, which appeals to me. I could feel something from us, from me, in him. I think I'm an African, you know, that dealt with this enough of this movement of rhythms from my childhood, and him, he was able to use it in his own way. That appeals to me.
I'm always interested in asking this question of people who've, especially those who've gone on to be pioneers themselves, what it was or who it was that first set them off on that path. Was Art Blakey the person you heard that made you think, this is what I want to do?
For drumming, yes, for sure. When, I mean, after starting to play drums locally during our life, with like everybody, you know, but when it comes to jazz, the jazz tunes, I've had enough little different jazz music from Blue Note, you know. Mm-hmm. The point is that the most appealing to me was the Jazz Messengers, which was Art Blakey, and this approach to drumming is quite different from the others. I really want to play like this guy.
Were you ever able to isolate what it was in particular about Art Blakey that made you think this is what I want to do? What was it that drew you to his drumming in particular?
Because he's a guy that's it's one guy that doesn't sound like one guy. I was asking somebody that, is it one drummer or two, three drummers playing? No, they say no, it's just one guy, you know, it's at Blakey. At Blakey, he's only one playing.
Which is something people often say of your drumming, of course, and it's talked about a lot, the way that you are able to keep up four different parts with each of your limbs. Was that something you had to teach yourself to do, or did that come more or less naturally?
No, I did. I need to work it out to make the four limbs work. Yeah, because when I started, it seems it was three limbs working with all the drummers I met in front of me, you know, playing before me. So I need four. And the fourth, why is it not working? I wouldn't know, so. But then I had to ask myself a question. I need to work around this. I'm sure that this fourth limb should be working.
Was it always important to you to be thought of, or I guess for the drums to be thought of, not merely as a keeper of the beat, but as an actual lead instrument? Because this was something else that was quite different about what you did from the start. In almost all bands, as you know, the drummer is there to keep time while everybody else plays around them. But that's rarely been the case when you've been playing. The drums are a star attraction.
That's how it started. Started with us is the drums, is a backline instrument. But to me, I look at it at that time too, that when I started listening to people like at Blakey, I never saw drums like backline instrument then. I saw it like upfront instrument, because there's a guy that controlling every shit there, you know? So how can you say this one is backline? It should be frontline, because it depends on the way they put it. It's not easy for a drummer to be front, which is that been placed at the back in the first place. So to put yourself in the front, meaning you have to work hard to be really be in front.
Is it like that with the composition of new material, like the songs on The Source? Are they, and there obviously there are other collaborators on the album, but are the songs built from the drums up? Is that what they start with?
Of course, yes. All what you had there was my drums first. Then I'm looking forward to different patterns, you know, patterns that are, you might not have had it before, but you know, when I'm going to create it, I want to make it to be a kind of trancy in a way, you know, like it's something that will keep on rolling in your mind there. Why is the music going on? I love to play solos, but sometimes it's distracting. When in a solo, in a very good groove, it's distraction. I would do it when I just want to make a display of things, you know, just like that, to just show that, yeah, I can handle solos properly, you know? Yeah, but it's not supposed to be fronting my work at all.
As you mentioned there, you don't just perform solo, and certainly not just under your own name. You do a great deal of collaborations with a vast and diverse array of musicians. But I just wondered about this, especially, I guess, when you've collaborated with people, whether it's like Damon Albarn or Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers, who may come from a more orthodox rock pop background. Is there ever a difficulty for them to adjusting to the way that you play? Do they hear rhythm the same way that you do?
Well, sometimes we need to explain some few things to each other. Right, you know, it's like they're always kind of not getting it right away, but I have a way to let them catch it really later, you know. The problem which they always ask is, where is my one? You know, where is the one in this pattern is going, but where is the one there? That is the problem. See, as it's always there, the one is there, you know, because when you want to count, you start counting from one anyway. So you don't count from two, you count from one. I say, so every time you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, it's 4-4. And so I say, the one is there. I say, okay, what is making them not really catching it? It's just because of when the first note you're going to hear from after counting, when I say 1, 2, the first note you're going to hear, it might not be on that one. It might be in the middle of the 1 and 2. that the first track you're going to hear is going to be this. Then sometimes then they take it like one, which is not the one. It's half. One. You see? One, two. You see? So that middle one there that they hear, they might think it's the one, which is not. Later, I explain to them, and they catch up with Damon, with Paul Simonon, with everybody, Flea, because it's the next instrument that comes after my drums. You know, when I write drums, it's the bass the next thing. So the bass must know where my one is in my pattern.
Because those two bass players you mentioned there, the bass players in particular, Flea and Paul Simonon, and that is a heck of a rhythm section in both cases. Before you start working with a collaborator, how aware usually are you of the other work they've done?
Paul and me, we have done the group and the Queen. Mm-hmm. Paul came in from after 15 years of not playing for the group and the Queen, and so it was kind of difficult at first, but later, you know, he got into it. Because Damon always say, you have to listen to Tony, and then it was okay at the end of the day. But with Flea wanted to meet Tony. From his dream was to play with Tony from the beginning, you know. He didn't know how he was going to catch it up, but when this program was created, this African Express, mm-hmm. and this African Express, we have to go and do it in Lagos. So Flea had the opportunity to with Damon, I mean, with all, we got this band together and did the celebration over there, the Africa Express 10 in Lagos. First one. He was able to play with me now because I saw that him is different from Paul. It's not the same approach. Him is more funkier, you know. So
they're very, very different bass players.
Yeah, very, very, very funkier. And he wanted to play with Tony. His dream was that. And now we met. And then we did it. We finished with the Africa Express in Lagos, back in London, and then did the Africa Express, the London one. And then after that, then the next thing was the studio, Damon studio, and then we started to do the Rocket Juice on the Moon.
Do you still spend much time in Lagos?
No, I don't stay in Lagos at all. You know, I just visit Lagos maybe once in a year. If this year I've not gone yet, you know, so maximum 2 weeks in Lagos.
Because I was just wondering, wanted to ask, of course, about Fela Kuti and Africa 70, not just about the musical influence, but whether in Nigeria now you perceive that there's been any, I guess, lasting cultural or political influence from what Africa 70 did.
No, I'm not sure. You know, look, Fela's children, they are there already to project their father's image. Whatever I had done, if they could handle it like their father did it in Lagos, I want to. I'm looking forward to that, but because it's not easy to implement what Fela had done in Lagos. Not any musician we ever tried, you know.
It was an extraordinary story, and I think it often gets forgotten how extraordinary it was, because there was an attempt at one point to sort of set up his own country within Nigeria, wasn't there?
You mean Fela?
Yeah.
Calcutta Republic was created by that. Yeah, it's all through his own experience, you know, of life, you know, what he passed through, you know, Fela was doing, that's why I never tried to copy Fela. Only thing I want to do with Fela is to play music, you know. I didn't want to, his policies are different for me, mm-hmm. his politics are different. I didn't want to be part of that. Music, yes.
You were always able to keep the two ideas or the two things separate?
Of course, yes. Very, very, because I made it clear to him. I went to tell him, you know, face to face with his friends around him, I'm with you musically. Your policies is yours. And your politics, your preaching is yours. Whatever it is yours. But I'm just concerned with the music. I made sure I handled it properly for him, not to have any problem, no faults. That's the only side I think I wanted to do. Because he's a genius, he has everything. Musically, you know, for me, he's a genius to me. I just want to be me, myself.
In terms of the music you're making now, it's a thing I'm always interested in asking people who have become recognised as a virtuoso on their particular instrument. Do you still spend much time practising, trying to learn things about the drums at this point?
I happen to be living in a country where, you know, you cannot make noise. I don't see myself practicing my drums at home. I never got a house like, you know, in the countryside. I'm alone in the forest. No, you know, I'm still living with the same flats with people connected. Can't play my drums in the house. But then, for practicing, as you said, but practicing, I think I'm practicing all the time in my head. My mind is practicing all the time. You see, my mind tells me what to play. When I drums in front of me right now, my mind tells me I want to write another pattern that I never had before myself. It's got to come because my mind commands it. Do it this way. And I have to create it and I have to make it work.
Tony Allen speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller. Let's hear, Rob, some of that new album now. This is from The Source. It's Moody Boy.
Tony Allen there with Moody Boy from the new album The Source, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Writer and creative Rob Sears has contributed work to projects ranging from the venerated storytelling and humour outlet McSweeney's to news organisation Reuters and major ad campaigns too.
He's now combining a bit of all those skills in a distinctly 21st century project, a new book called The Beautiful Poetry of Donald Trump. The book compiles snippets of all the Trumpisms we know of so far, from sources ranging from Twitter to the American Presidency Project, to create new and creative verses. Here's the impressionist John Culshaw reciting a few.
I'm really rich. I'm very proud of my new crystal collection. I have a Gucci store that's worth more than Romney. I order thousands of televisions a year. Six people do nothing but sort my mail. Sorry, haters and losers. He who has the gold makes the rules.
And Rob Sears, the author of this anthology of poetry, possibly an anthology of poetry, possibly the originator of it, is here with us in the studio. Welcome to the programme, Rob.
Thank you.
At what point during Trump's campaign did you think there is something unnervingly poetical about this man and his pronouncements?
I think it was during the Republican primaries, when it seemed as if every day he came up with another quote that sort of upped the stakes just a little bit more. And it was the quotes themselves often that did it. He would just say something a little bit more extreme than you expected, and it seemed like it was the work of somebody who was using language, not exactly like a poet, but he was using it.
Yeah, there's something epigrammatical about those things.
Well, no, and there's the rub, because it was always a feature of people talking about his lack of erudition, and obviously it highlights in the book how he insists he's read many of the great writers, you know, the great novelists, but people always used it as a stick to beat him with. But there's a certain weird, I don't want to call it purity, but there is something very simple and quite striking about a lot of his pronouncements.
It's not easy to use to arrive at such a pared down vocabulary as he has, and he used to use slightly more words earlier in his life. He's got a distinct style, which is more than you can say for a lot of politicians.
Is that the fact then? You've obviously studied his, not only the things that he said, but the patterns and the ways that he says them, to make them into the poetry as they are in the book. And we should say that these are cut-ups of various speeches and excerpts of some of the books he's written in order to make poems and a book of poetry, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I haven't really written these poems. I've just arranged them.
You have arranged, yeah.
Every word is Trump's. But each line is an intact verbatim quote of his, either from a tweet or from a Playboy interview or from a speech.
Do you feel that it is by luck or by design that Trump has happened upon this memorable, great, a memorable way of communicating with the world and with an electorate?
I don't think that it's by design. I think that he's a natural at what he does, and the reason why he's reached the position that he has is that he communicates in such a sort of stripped down, universal way. I mean, sometimes he's not easy to understand, but you always feel as if he's communicating to everybody. I think that's allowed him to become successful. I don't ever see him stepping back and analysing how he speaks or what his strategy is going to be. I think it all comes naturally. That's my,
yeah. You sort of wonder how close his advisors doctor his language, because his language is the most successful part of his kind of a part of the Trump machine in a way. And you wonder whether some people would have advised him to have cleaned up his act, have started writing sort of grander speeches, adopting a bit of the JFK-ness or the Obama-ness of oratory. Mm. And he's gone exactly the other way. You wonder, don't you? I mean, I wonder if you thought about this when you're putting the poems together, at what point that decision, if it was one, was made.
So who knows? But I think part of the reason why some people like him is that it's very hard to imagine him being controlled by spin doctors.
And yeah.
I mean, I feel like he invents his own memorable phrases to use again and again, rather than having them fed to him. And I don't think he's predictable either. I imagine his kind of aides and controllers get very frustrated watching from the sidelines when he sort of oversteps what they planned for him to say.
Now, Rob, he's rendered the POTUS on the cover in this sort of very, you know, he's looking wistfully out to the horizon.
That's Dylan Thomas's body.
He's got the cravat. So it's Dylan Thomas through and through, and it's called, playfully, I guess, The Beautiful Poetry of Donald Trump. But did it surprise you, perhaps not given that you were writing the book, that you could sort of find beauty, even with an arched eyebrow, in what I would generally term as mainly kind of ravings, which they are frequently from Trump?
Well, it's very kind of you to say that there's beauty in there. I don't know if there is, because most of the poems are kind of doggerel or haiku. They're kind of fairly simple forms, because it's extremely challenging to arrange quotes in a way that creates
sophisticated haikus. You mentioned haiku. In those haikus, there's definitely a sort of, I don't know, sort of pure stripped down.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't elegance, I don't know, which would seem impossible from the source material.
It's sort of telegraphic, I think, his language. The idea of the poems is that they give you, sometimes there are contrasts between what he'll say in public and what he'll say in private, or there are, he'll speak in exactly the same register about celebrity culture and about the nuclear fate of the world, in the same. And when you arrange them right next to each other, you get an interesting tension.
There's a thing about his repetition of the last word of the sentence, or the word that he wants to put the most stress on. Mm-hmm. So if he wants to put that word in italics, rather than just say it in italics, he also repeats that word as if in an offhand gesture to someone off stage. You know? And that's a funny thing. In Martin Amis's new book of criticism, he picks up on this point of Trump's become a master of not just the one sentence paragraph, but the one word paragraph. a lot of that is simply the word period. You know, like, yeah. I am a clever man, far from period. This must have been something quite funny to play around with, how short you could make some of these sentences in these poems, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's sort of those sort of funny line breaks that you get in modern poetry.
Yeah.
It very much lends itself to that. And I'm not the only person who's written a book along these lines. Other people have done it, taking intact quotes and adding their own line breaks to kind of explore his sort of repetitive mind.
Yeah.
I mean, mine works in a slightly different way, because the quotes are all from different sources. So you rarely get the that kind of punchy staccato rhythms.
Rob, I wanted to ask you, it says quite pointedly, strictly unauthorised on the cover. One imagines at the insistence or suggestion of some of my learned friends.
Correct.
Did it ever enter your head that you might be the recipient of some of Donald Trump's Twitter largesse, and he'd say, "See, this man, Rob Sears, smart guy, recognises my words, recognise my words."
Well, I think that's how he received it. If you ever read it,
But that could happen. Are you worried about that?
Well, I'm not worried about his lawyers particularly, because every quote has been, you know, double checked, and they're all from reliable sources, I believe. Perhaps I'm putting myself up to be shot at.
Do get in touch with us if you take it.
If Donald Trump can talk in italics, Rob Sears can talk in asterisks.
I also haven't really taken him out of context. I made a deliberate decision to I would put lines together in a really silly way to imply that he believes complete absurdities where nobody would think he ever thought that. For instance, there's a poem about his hair. It says, there's quite a few poems about his hair, but there's one that goes simply, slowly the hair dries. It's a process that can take 18 months to 2 years. So the quote about 18 months to 2 years,
I took that as being a verbatim quote.
You did? Yeah. Well, it is a verbatim quote about some sort of getting some sort of policy through Congress, of course. So I allowed myself to do that, but I've not put two things together where it implies that he said something rude about someone he was actually talking about somebody else. I've been fairly careful there. Because I think the truth is enough. There's no need.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting, and I guess that's an interesting question to wrestle with, because all during the campaign, people said, well, look, yes, it's funny now, we can poke fun, but he's not going to win. And then he won. And people said, well, he won't stick around. And then he's still here. And there's always been that idea that, you know, if you let the sort of the idiot that shouts loudest in the room shout, then the truth will out. But it doesn't seem to have happened. I don't know. Have we reached some sort of, not this silly post-truth or whatever, but is this a new environment where the things don't speak for themselves? Because surely if things spoke for themselves, he wouldn't even be in the White House.
He puts himself out there. There's not that much about Trump that you have to kind of...
There's not much depth, is there?
No, there's not. And I mean, it's just, there's a general point about satire. I feel like in the past and with other politicians, satire has been about kind of surfacing things that were a bit below the surface. Like if you look at Dr. Strangelove, that was all about bringing out this nuclear logic that people were using in their rhetoric and in their thinking, but it was nobody had quite brought it out so clearly as that film. And something like The Thick of It, I feel as if it's kind of bringing out this truth that these people aren't in control at all. They're all at the mercy of events, but they talk like they're in control. So it's kind of bringing out an uncomfortable truth. With Trump, I feel as if everything is right there on the surface. Yeah. All of his dog whistles, we can all hear them. There are no secrets, really. So it doesn't seem to me that there's a need to exaggerate what he says. I think you can just use the exact quotes. And if you look at some like Alec Baldwin's impressions of him, excellent impressions, I think they've been at their best when he just repeats Trump's actual words. when he invents his own words or has the scriptwriters do it for him, I don't think the sketches are as effective.
I think there lies a fantastic ringing indictment of the whole thing, right? There is nothing stranger than the truth, I suppose. Do you have a favourite in here? Is there something that kind of epitomises the project? I wonder, Rob. Not asking you to kill any of your darlings in the book necessarily, but
the early ones I wrote that rhymed were perhaps the ones I was proudest of, because they sort of proved that the concept would work. It's called MAGA! ! Will Smith did a great job by smacking the guy reporter who kissed him. Together, we're going to fix our rigged system. Sarah Jessica Parker voted unsexiest woman alive. I agree. We must keep evil out of our country. A person who's very flat-chested is very hard to be a 10. We're going to make America great again.
Wow. See, it does. I think it works rather well with your voice, Rob, actually. There is a distance from it as well, as good as John Coleshaw is, right? Rob Sears, thank you very much indeed for providing the world with the great service that is the beautiful poetry of Donald Trump.
Thank you very much.
We last heard from musician Emmy the Great on the Monocle Weekly a little over a year ago, when she gave us a primer in speaking the languages and dialects found in China. She'd been exploring the Chinese side of her heritage for her latest record, Second Love.
She returns today to discuss an equally intriguing musical project, a new musical and very funny version of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Emmy, or Emily Moss, as she's also known, has supplied the music, working with the stand-up comedian Sarah Pascoe and the theatre director Susanna Trezillian. We'll be talking to Emma in just a moment, but first, here's a clip.
Let's take this moment to pause. I see you're holding your applause.
Because you think that we are suffering from an ailment called
Brother, please, this is not your century. Don't judge us for knowing everybody's worth. It's not like we can just get work. We've never had an education. It's not funny. We need money, money, money.
It is funny. Emma joins us on the line now from New York City to tell us more. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, Emma. Nice to have you with us. This sounds great. This sounds like it's got a kind of broad depth of kind of musical knowing musical theatre behind it. How did you kick off with this?
Well, it's not really a musical. It's just a very very different type of play. I think Sarah's brain is so, I don't know if you've come across her book as well as her work, and just are you aware of the breadth of her kind
of her learning? No, not really. I mean, I kind of feel that, although having said that, this is a kind of, with you and Sarah and Susanna as well, who better equipped to reboot, or not reboot, but find the funny side of Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen, I suppose, in the early years of the 21st century, right? Three women who kind of want to shine a light on the amusing and ironic bits of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, the reason why there are songs is because Sarah was writing the play and it got to the point where she was like, I've run out of different perspectives to look at the book. I'm going to throw a song in here. So that's why they appear. And at first I was really worried that they'd be kind of random, but people seem to understand it and they seem to be enjoying it. As you say, Susanna is the exact perfect person to pull it all together. She's just got this incredible ability to pull things together and make it work. Thank God, really, because it was pretty surreal at some points in rehearsal.
Well, it sounds like nicely so, because there's, I mean, when I said sort of musical theatre in that, there is something of the, like, there's something Noel Coward-ish, there's something kind of Peter Skellenish about this this kind of cadence, this kind of prim and amusing and kind of slightly taking the mickey out of its Regency-ness, I suppose.
Oh yeah, that song is definitely based on Noel Coward, but I'm afraid that all the songs have different styles.
Thanks a lot. There goes all my other questions.
Sorry about that. No, but sorry to the audiences as well. So in the lead up to writing them, I was listening to Hamilton, Groundhog Day, and Sister Act. That's all I can say.
that's the full contemporary canon. I think that's fine.
Yeah, that's...
I was going to ask you, because Rob was saying there that, you know, he was sort of chuckled as we heard some of that little clip, and it's funny stuff. Is Pride and Prejudice funnier than some people give it credit for? Because, you know, you think of the dramatizations, they're often fairly, they can be a little po-faced, and it's actually, I mean, it is quite a fun, the source material is quite funny if you know where to look, right?
I think people know that Jane Austen is funny. I mean, I think like no matter which adaptation, I've only seen the BBC, but the moment that Mr. Collins, for example, comes on, you just start laughing. I don't think you can avoid the humour. And certainly I was at the first five performances, and every night someone would come up to me afterwards and say, a lot of the laughs are because of the team, but most of the laughs are because of Jane. And that's true. Basically a comedian.
She's a comedian, that Austen. So which bits, I mean, I'm interested in how you and Sarah put this together. When did she turn to you for sort of musical light relief and want that, as you said, extra kind of angle or extra kind of vantage point from which to tell the story then?
Well, the three of us had a WhatsApp group. I think all great work comes from a WhatsApp group. So we started off, we met at the British Library to talk about it for the first time. We went to visit her desk, which is on display there. So yeah, then we set up our group and then we were just constantly talking. And during that time, Sarah was writing the script, and every time we discovered something, we'd throw it into the group. So there'd just be the soup. And then when I received the script, there were just all these moments that, where it said, song here, it's called this. I'd be like,
great.
Okay, I've got the title. I think because we were really quite connected all the time, it was just a constant CC, to use modern internet terms. I kind of knew what they were talking about without having to ask too many questions, which I think is really helpful. in this situation.
And I guess that's useful to have that kind of shorthand almost when you're working on a true collaboration. You mentioned, Emma, about the variety of musical styles and influences. Was that collaborative? Was the idea always that you would draw from these disparate influences and there wouldn't be a sort of a musical, I don't know, motif that would run through it? It would be slightly almost schizophrenic, but in a really fun way.
At the beginning, Susanna sat me down and was like, we're going to need a language. The music necessary, other than the original songs, which are all kind of in their own style in this sort of vaguely postmodern, but not hopefully not annoyingly postmodern way, all the score music had to be either Regency or timeless, a kind of note to the fact that we are a modern audience. So she made me make up this language that I kept forgetting so that I could actually get my head around all the different types of music that was necessary. There'd be like music that they can hear or music that is like the hand of time. So thankfully we had that, otherwise I don't think I could ever have quite cleared the requirements.
So it sounds there's obviously a complexity to how you weave the music in through what is obviously a well-known story, but maybe an unusual way of telling that story, and from different perspectives, differing perspectives I presume on the stage than were offered in the book. But in the end, when the proof of the pudding is in the eating, I guess this whole thing comes together, gels together. So we understand why there's a song here, and we understand why it's sung in this way. That's the way. Was there a moment during rehearsals when it just sort of clicked, when the songs, when the libretto met the words in the play, I suppose, and suddenly it clicked?
We never knew it was going to work.
That's different saying you never thought it was going to work, which I'm relieved
at. No, it's not that we never thought. It was just that we just had this kind of like, okay, we believe, we believe, we believe. And the actors were amazing. The actors have to do like 3 or 4 roles each. The play has just so many characters. And we only had, I think, 9 actors. And they were just so brilliant. And they just took it on the chin, and they would do music rehearsals, and then they would do play rehearsals. And then when on opening night, when the final song came on, I started crying, like weeping and weeping into Susanna's lap, which I think is a sign that I thought it worked, and also a sign that there was a part of me that wasn't sure that it would.
Well, also presumably it's that there's always, people are always going on journeys with this stuff, right? But it obviously sounds like you did, and there is something. I mean, did you, are there any parts of that source material, Tom was saying it's very funny, that still maintain true to life now? Are there parts of the story that hit you as well?
I mean, during our research, I did a lot of research into conditions for women at the time. I can't completely, I think it was for Don't Judge Us, the song that you played, which is about entailment, the entailment law, which still exists, I think, where estate can only be passed to the first male heir and can't be proportioned between family members. So I had to do a lot of research into women's lives at the time. And there were these conduct books, one for men and one for women. And the one for men was like, how to go on an adventure, how to be a leader, how to be a good poet, all this stuff, just really exciting, dynamic stuff. And then the women's conduct book said, on behaviour for virgins, on behaviour for wives, on behaviour for widows.
Wow. Yeah.
And that was written in the, I want to say, 18th century. And when I looked at it, I thought, gosh, we still kind of live in these conditions. So it was really eye-opening to see that the things that the Bennett sisters are battling against are not totally gone. They're quite recognisable in our own lives. So it was a bit sobering, but at the same time it brought us closer to the Bennett sisters.
Indeed. I was going to ask you, Emma, about looking forward, because we talked about your, I think one of your last albums when we spoke a year or so ago. Do you think this will change your, I don't know, the things that you get most passionate about when it comes to work? Because a lot of people particularly who look at that sort of musical, or call it what you will, do that work on those kind of projects, they end up falling in love again with that medium. And then they say, do you know what, this is going to be it now. And they end up adapting and setting to music loads of other works. Could you see yourself going down that avenue? Or do you think one dip of the toe in the water is probably enough?
I loved writing these songs. I love putting information in songs. And when you make sort of pop music, there's always someone saying there's too much information in this. What are you trying to do, educate people? So yeah, I definitely want to write more songs like this. And I would love to write a musical. But I also understand that it takes a lot of time, so I'm not saying that next year my musical will be on Broadway. It's just something that definitely opened in my brain.
Thank you very much, Emma. And Pride and Prejudice will be at the York's Theatre Royal from the 4th until the 14th of October.
There we go, Rob. Another show bites the dust. I have to be honest. I mean, I'm inspired every time we enjoy our great guests on the Monocle Weekly.
Yeah.
What about musical theatre? I could imagine you being quite a skilled librettist.
Librettist.
An opera, musical. Is there source material
what do you
that you've
think
often
we should,
thought?
I think there's enough comedy in the last 10 years of Monocle to see us through an amazing musical, don't
book,
you think?
The Book of Monocle.
Let's talk about the Book of Monocle. Let's talk about some. Let's do some casting. Dare we do this, or is this staying on dangerous ground?
I think it could be P45 Central if we follow that through to its logical conclusion.
Yeah, okay.
But other source material? I don't know. I always like the idea of taking rather po-faced source material and giving it the musical treatment. I always think that's
something,
that works
something by Richard Dawkins, possibly.
A Brief History of Time.
A Brief History of Time, yeah. Okay, the musical.
Yeah.
Now that is something I'd
like to see. Cha-cha-cha, something like that. I don't know. I can see it already.
Okay, what else have we got?
I don't know. What's interesting is, and I wonder how...
Let's not get into religious stuff.
How Emmy the Great... Yeah, I've offended enough people recently.
Okay.
How, you know, in a musical, when you have that moment when the character signposts that they're about to break into song, and that's essentially why I don't get on.
Does that have a
musicals.
Name? That kind of suddenly you can see them arranging their waistcoats as they need to take
exactly,
in more air.
Exactly, yeah, and you're like, oh, it's coming.
It's coming. Yeah.
And that for me, I've always struggled with that. Book of Mormon, absolutely love. Seen it 2 times, in fact.
Yeah.
But I just find that moment tricky, and I wonder how. I'm sure someone as skilled as Emmy the Great has managed to elegantly sidestep that.
I think she's done it probably with, she's done it sort of actually, and she's done it ironically, knowing her and her kind of, her nouse.
Yeah.
But you're right. Let's explore the actual, what that is, what that moment is called, when someone kind of goes, why are you so upset? And you go, well, it's a bit like this. And
no, exactly.
It's that awful
there
moment.
There must be some sort of faux Latin musical term that would...
There must be, yes.
Write
exactly.
in with your suggestions
write
for next week's programme.
If not, I feel like it's one of those words that Douglas Adams would have come up with.
In fact, he probably already
He probably already did it. Thank you, everybody. And shall we thank our pals behind the glass?
Why not? Tom Hall and Fernando Augusto Pacheco were the producers. Our researcher was Mariana Lagrasta, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We shall be back. Perhaps you and I, Rob. Perhaps another.
Who knows?
From the cast.
Maybe
of
we should be like two ships that pass in the night. Maybe
exactly.
We should be like two tugboats.
Or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, if you will.
Some rude mechanicals, put it that way. Okay. So for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.